Welcome to the Westminster Town Hall Forum, Voices of Conscience from an Ethical Perspective. My name is Tim Hart Anderson. I am the senior pastor here at Westminster Presbyterian Church, and I will be moderating today's forum. The forum originates from Westminster Church in beautiful downtown Minneapolis. I'm very pleased to welcome David Gergen as the third speaker in our fall series of the Westminster Town Hall Forum. We feel especially privileged to have a true Beltway insider with us during this exciting election week. David Gergen has been a fixture on the national political scene for the last quarter century. He has served as advisor to four presidents, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Ronald Reagan, and Bill Clinton. He was a reporter covering the Carter White House and a campaign aide to George Bush. The other George Bush. We may be the first audience in America to hear what his new job will be under the next administration. Whosever it will be. David is joining us today after a whirlwind week, as you might imagine, covering the election in his current capacity as editor-in-large for U.S. News and World Report and commentator for CNBC and the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. He is also a professor at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. David's new book, Eyewitness to Power, is a fascinating account of presidential leadership. What makes a president great? Just in my lifetime, I have seen the criteria evolve as outside influences such as the media and political action groups have changed the way we view the presidency. David will speak to us today on the seven core elements that a leader must possess in order to be considered great. As we will hear, some of the core elements are internal, the sort of moral compass that we still expect from our leaders. Some are of the more external variety, such as the ability to mobilize followers. I know that I speak for all of us when I say that I very much look forward to hearing about his experience in Washington, his comments on the current situation with the presidential election, and what we may have to look forward to in the next administration when all is settled. Please join me in welcoming David Gergen.
Thank you, Reverend Anderson, and thank all of you here at the Westminster Town Hall Forum. I'm honored to walk in the footsteps of so many distinguished people who have come here to speak to you in this forum. I'm especially honored that so many of you chose to join us today on a blustery day here in Minneapolis. But we have much to talk about, and I'm glad to see you. Ordinarily, I might, talk about my book, Eyewitness to Power, but all of us over the past 72 hours have been eyewitness to a dramatic, historic turn of events here in our national elections, and I thought it might be more appropriate to direct our attentions to those elections and to what faces the next leader of this country, if we might. As we speak, or as we gather here, the press is reporting that in Florida, the lead that Governor Bush had of some 1,700 votes is down to about 700 at this point. Two-thirds of the counties have reported. There are another third left to go. We may have the results by the end of the day. There are still absentee ballots to be counted after those results come in. And then there's the fascinating question of whether legal suits will be pressed to try to challenge alleged voting irregularities and whether this will eventually be wound up in the courts and indeed whether we might, as some commentators are suggesting this morning in the newspapers, face another vote in some portions of Florida or in all of the state. I hope that for the sake of the country, that the counting alone and the absentee ballots will resolve this matter. I'm reminded that some 40 years ago we had a similar election in which there were allegations of irregularities in Illinois and in Texas, when President Kennedy won the election. There were many who thought that in the city of Chicago, an astonishing number of people rose up from the graveyards to cast their ballots. And perhaps that ought to be challenged in court. And Richard Nixon, who was the loser by the original count, decided not to go forward with legal challenges. He wrote in his autobiography that he thought it was important for the country to resolve things quickly and to move on so that the next administration could be shaped and formed and clouds would not hang over the election. Several of his biographers wrote that that was one of his finest hours and a career that was not always known for being generous toward his enemies or toward his opponents, that at that particular moment he chose to follow a more dignified route, one which allowed the election to reach closure and people to move on. I hope for the nation's sake that when the voting is counted, one way or the other, we will have a winner and we will not face legal challenges that extend far into the night. It will not be fair to either winner who emerges. But we'll have to wait and see how this all comes out. What I would like to suggest today is that whoever wins this election, and the odds favor Governor Bush, but Vice President Gore still has a fighting chance at the end of the day. Whoever wins this election is going to face one of the stiffest challenges any victor has faced in the history of the presidency, to try to bring the country together, to govern, to bring Congress together, to lead. All of this is going to be an overwhelming challenge that I think involves the rest of us as citizens as well. I say that because one of the most important aspects of leadership in the presidency is to get off to a fast start. The window of opportunity in the presidency is very, very small. Lyndon Johnson said after he was elected in 1964 by a massive numbers, he told his aides, "We have a year. Each day that goes by, we will lose power. And a year from now, we will not be able to count on the Congress to focus on anything other than their own re-elections and the off-year elections. We have to hit the ground running." That was essentially his message. And it's a message that has echoed down from one administration to the next. The last president who got off to a fast start, some of you may disagree with his policies, but he was the last one to really exhibit strong leadership in the early going and able to guide the destiny of the nation, was Ronald Reagan in 1980. He was like Lyndon Johnson. Lyndon Johnson got off to a fast start after his 1964 election. Now, what characterized for both Johnson and for Reagan, what characterized their elections? Each of them won by a large margin in the popular vote. Each of them could go back into the districts of the other party and say, you know, you may not agree with my policies, but there are a lot of people in your district who agree with me and my policies, and we really ought to work together, and can't you find some way in your heart to come and work with me on this? Secondly, each man had coattails. Each man was able to bring in other people from his own party into the Congress. Reagan won the Senate, and he brought many members of the House in with him. And thirdly, both Johnson and Reagan, in their victories, had a policy mandate. They had a clear signal to the American people that the agenda they had set forward in the campaign was one that was embraced by a majority and therefore one that the Congress should enact or should act upon. In each case, the president, the newly elected president, could go to Congress and say, "I understand not everyone here agrees with what I am proposing, but I'm the only person here who was elected by all the people. And in my election campaign, I set forward two or three clear goals. Everybody knew what they were. They had a chance to say yay or nay. And in voting yay, they sent a signal here to Washington that we should proceed with this agenda. So please work with me." And that carried strong appeal. And what I would suggest to you in this case is that whether the winner is Bush or Gore, neither man will have any of those accomplishments to bring to the Congress or bring before the people. Neither of these men will have swept the country with a large popular vote. Even as we gather here today in an election that drew over 100 million votes, they're separated in the popular vote by less than 100,000. We don't know at this point whether Vice President Gore will continue to be the winner of the popular vote, or whether when all the absentee ballots are counted in California and Oregon and elsewhere, in fact, Governor Bush will emerge with a popular vote. What we do know is that neither man won 50% of a popular vote. What we do know is that neither man had a resounding victory. The country is split right down the middle. We're divided in so many different ways. We're divided in part by income. The higher the income, the more Republican the vote. We're divided in part by education. The lower the education, the more Democratic the vote, except when you get to postgraduate studies. And then, as you can imagine, all those PhDs and everybody, they voted heavily Democrat. Where is Tim Penny? He can tell us about academics. We're divided by race. Whites voted heavily Republican. Blacks voted overwhelmingly Democratic. Governor Bush, after that convention in which there were so many minorities on display, wound up with a smaller percentage of the black vote than Bob Dole had 4 years ago. He increased his Hispanic vote, the Hispanic share, but went down in the black share. We're divided as well by where we live, whether we live in large cities or small cities. In cities of over 500,000 population, the Democrats won the presidential race. They got 75% of the vote. In cities between 50 and 500,000, the Democrats got 60% of the vote. In cities below 50,000, the Republicans won 60% of the vote. We wound up in an election in which half the people who voted said that if Al Gore were the president, they would either be concerned or scared. Similarly, we wound up in an election in which half the people who voted said that if George W. Bush were the president, they would be concerned or scared. It was a mixed message on the policy decisions as well. In many, many states where Governor Bush won, one of the critical elements of his agenda, the major tax cut program he is putting forward, was listed way down on the list of priorities of people who voted for him in terms of what they would like to see done with the surplus. So we have a country that is heavily divided. Neither man won a big popular vote. When it comes to coattails, Al Gore can claim something of coattails. The Democrats picked up 4 seats in the Senate and perhaps a fifth. We still did not have the results out of Washington. They picked up just a tiny amount in the House. George W. Bush certainly can't claim to have coattails given those results. But in fact, we have left the Congress now as evenly divided as the country itself. In the Senate, it's 50-49 at this point. Only 3 times in the entire history of the Republic has the Senate been that closely divided. The House of Representatives will be as closely divided as any time in the last 45 years, and depending on the results, we may have the narrowest margin in the House of Representatives since the Civil War. Congress is extremely closely divided. Neither candidate can claim that he has swept the country and had coattails. And finally, neither candidate can claim that he has a mandate. It's just very clear that in the voting this time, neither man captured the country's imagination with his program. In many, many instances, the votes were made more on the basis of personality than on program. Now, what this means is that the president-elect, whoever he may be, emerges from this election weakened. No matter what happens in Florida, if Governor Bush wins this, there will always be a perception among Democrats that somehow they got cheated out of it in Florida. What happened to those 19,000 votes in Palm Beach? The votes that were disqualified, votes that normally go heavily into the Democratic camp. Many, many people have a hard time imagining the voters of Palm Beach, Florida, voting heavily for Pat Buchanan. The last time a number of us looked, some of Pat's speeches were still being translated from German. So there will always be that lingering question. Just as many Republicans thought they were robbed back in 1960, there will always be that lingering question among Democrats if Governor Bush is proclaimed the winner, were they robbed this time. And I can tell you, if the Democrats go to court with this, or if this thing is turned around through some kind of court decision, there will be Republicans who will stand on their hind legs for a long time to come, proclaiming this was not fair. I think, unfortunately, sadly for the country, there are going to be question marks hanging over the outcome, no matter which way this comes out. And frankly, it's not fair to the winner. Neither one of these men was responsible for the voting process in Florida. Voting in this country, just like our court system, has always had a rough sense about it. There have always been irregularities in our voting. We just haven't paid much attention to it because usually the results are so overwhelming one way or the other that we don't need to get into the micro investigation of what happened in this particular ballot box or that particular ballot box. But if you went into any state in the country, you probably would find these questions, but it's been true of Florida for a long time. So the winner, sadly, is going to emerge somehow with this question mark over the victory that's there. That's tough for someone to come out of this. Now, beyond that, think about it this way in terms of the politics of it. The Congress of the United States, this closely divided, each side is going to look upon the next 2 years and indeed upon the next 4 years as a struggle, as a continuing struggle for power. Each side is going to claw away to see if they can't somehow get the upper hand. Traditionally in American politics, we have one party that's a strong majority party and one that's a minority party. As V.O. Key, the political scientist, once put it, one party is the sun and the other is the moon. The moon always lives in the reflected glory of the sun. And that kind of politics has allowed us to reach a certain kind of harmony in our legislative activities, a certain kind of balance, a certain comedy between the parties, because the minority party has understood that the pendulum has to swing in a big way in order for it to really have a chance to govern. But when it's this closely divided, something we haven't seen since the late 19th century, then you have enormous friction in our politics. In the late 19th century, which was similar in the same way, the parties clawed at each other regularly. It was a mean, dispiriting time in our politics. A lot of good people didn't go into politics at that time. Sounds very familiar, right? It was a Teddy Roosevelt who went to Harvard, where the elite said they didn't want to have anything to do with politics. They didn't want to get involved with it. It was an arena that somehow was corrupted. He went against the grain and said, no, we have to bring reformers into politics. And he was willing to take it on and help to bring on the progressive movement. Back in the early part of the 20th century. But the last part of the 19th century, our politics almost stank with the poison that existed between the parties, and that's because they were so closely matched. So it's very, very likely that each party is going to be at the other one's throat before long. Think about this if you're a Democrat. If George W. Bush gets elected, for the last 9 presidencies in a row, the newly elected president, after 2 years in office, has found that his party has lost seats in the midterm elections. If history is a guide, and it often is, 2 years from now, if George W. Bush is elected, the Democrats have a strong chance of picking up seats. That means they could take control of the Senate when a lot of vulnerable Republican senators are up, and they could take control of the House. Now their incentive then is very powerful to look after themselves and not look after the best interests of the country. to look after their own political interests, take the House and the Senate back in the year 2002, and then scramble to find a candidate who can go up in 2004 and take the whole thing back, and then they can be off to the races with a lot of reforms. They can reform all the institutions they care about. From a Republican point of view, it works just the opposite. If you're a Republican, you say, if we get the White House, we get the House, we get the Senate, that will be the first time we have done that in half a century. Well, you have to go all the way back to the first 2 years of the Eisenhower administration to find a time when the Republicans simultaneously controlled the White House, the House, and the Senate. And their view will be, let's use this time to push forward our agenda, because this is a golden opportunity, one we've worked for all our lives. Let's not let it slip from our grasp. Let's enact our agenda. And more than anything else, let's make sure we hold on to power 2 years from now. Each party then has a huge, huge incentive to protect its own over the next 2 years. And usually protecting your own means you're not protecting the best interests of the country. You're not trying to work in a bipartisan way. You're not trying to sort of see if you can reach consensus. Usually it means you pay lip service to the notion of getting along. But down below the surface, you do what you can to gut the other side. That's the way politics has been practiced in Washington for a low too many years here in the recent past. So we have a real challenge for the next president. I think it's been a long time since the mountain ahead is so steep as it is for the next president. And again, I think it involves us. Let me just tell you about the next president, and I'll talk about us for a moment. For the next president, it seems to me the temptation is going to be to take side with your party. If you're George W. Bush, to take side with the conservatives who, after all, mobilized the armies that helped you win the election. They have been rather quiet over during the course of this election period. The NRA, the Christian Coalition, and the others have been rather quiet, but they did put their troops out there at the ballot boxes. They did help him get elected. There is a cultural conflict in this country. Some believe a cultural war. Their temptation is going to be to join up with that group and press forward Supreme Court appointments and the rest. On the other side, if you're Al Gore and you finally eke this out, you have an obligation you will feel to the AFL-CIO, to the NAACP, and to the others who worked so hard to get the voter numbers up, and they did a superb job getting a black vote up in this election. And you're going to feel a very strong obligation to work with them and forget the people on the other side. But I would just argue that for the sake of the country, whoever wins this, that they want to get something done for the country, are going to have to the winner will have to resist that temptation. The winner is going to have to reach out a hand to the other side and say, if we're going to get anything done, we have to work together, because we don't have the votes on either side to get serious legislation done in the next 2 years or the next 4 years, just on one side alone. Progress is only going to come if we have a consensus, if people work toward a consensus. Now, let me tell you, there are those on Wall Street today who believe the best thing Washington can do for the next 2 or 3 or 4 years is to be deadlocked. Gridlock is reviewed favorably in Wall Street. Well, their view is, listen, if government gets too active, they always mess it up. And if they just don't do anything and stay out of the way, we can have a thriving economy. Look at the bond markets. The bond markets get scared if they think the Republicans are going to control everything and cut taxes too much, or if the Democrats are going to control everything and spend too much. That's bad news in the bond markets. They see more inflation coming from that. And the equity markets prefer gridlock. The equity markets basically would prefer a Republican president, a Democratic House. That's, and from their point of view, the less change, the better. But from the country's overall point of view, I think that may be right in the short term from a financial standpoint. But in the long term, the country needs to resolve some of the challenges that we face without waiting. Whoever the next president is, let's say he survives this challenge, stays in office, and then gets elected to a second term. Before he leaves the White House, the first baby boomers will begin to retire. We are that close to that wave of baby boomers hitting the retirement system, hitting the Social Security system, hitting the Medicare system, and all of these other systems we have set up to provide safety nets, and to provide help for those who are in retirement. All of those systems need repair before the baby boomers retire. We are not ready to deal with the costs of the baby boom retirement. We have to look at the Social Security system, we have to look at the Medicare system, and we have to prepare both of them for the baby boom retirement, and that may well happen in the term of the next president. It's critical, then, that both sides be able to work together. Similarly, if you look at the other needs of the country, whether it be education or prescription drugs or patients' bill of rights or any number of other issues that you can think about, they are pressing in upon us, and more gridlock is not in our interest. What's in our interest is to see if we can reach some solution, some sort of consensus, and move on. Maybe it's not the best consensus, but at least it starts us down that path. When the health care initiative of the Clinton administration, which in my judgment they were courageous to put it forward, I think it was wrong-headed in the way it was put together. But when it failed, when that health care initiative failed in 1993-94, we failed a lot of Americans in this country who did not have health insurance. And the number of Americans in this country who do not have health insurance has gone straight up since the failure of that health care initiative. It would have been so much better had we reached at least partial agreement on health care back in 93-94. Yes, it would not have been the perfect solution. But the perfect is often the enemy of the good. And what's best is to go ahead and strike a solution, see if you can't get somewhere, and then move on. And my suggestion to you is the next president, it's in terms of leadership, instead of answering that siren song over on the right side or on the left side of the political spectrum, what's important is to try to bring this country together and see if we can't have, as Governor Bush says, a fresh start, a new season that is not so characterized by the cynicism that we've had of the past. So I think that the leadership is going to come from someone who says, I'm prepared to reach out, I'm prepared to open work with the other side, I'm prepared to have them here at the White House, and I want to sit down and see if we can't hammer out some solutions together. But I'd just like to add this final point, and I'll stop. It seems to me that this election leaves responsibility in our hands as citizens, too. We may have sent somebody to the White House, but we haven't settled anything in this country. We are so closely divided ourselves that we have given somebody, whether it be Al Gore or George W. Bush, the responsibility of the presidency. But we haven't given them the tools to get the job done. Neither one of these men is going to have the power or the glory that's required to work and go forward. And what I would suggest is, whoever the winner is, because we, the citizens, have been so closely divided about what we've chosen to do here, that a special responsibility falls upon us to treat the winner, whoever it may be, with a greater generosity of spirit and a greater sense of understanding that individual is going to need. If the winner acts in a generous spirit, if the winner comes out of this and says, I want to bind the country up, it seems to me our responsibility is to respond to that call, to say that we have an interest in this too, because there's going to be a temptation out across the land to maintain our partisan divisions, to maintain our ideological divisions, to maintain our economic divisions, our educational divisions, when in fact we need to have a view toward our leadership that if they're willing to act in the right spirit, then we're willing to embrace them and understand that the winner may stumble a few times, but we don't immediately upon having the winner stumble, we don't say, throw the bum out. And you think back to the early days of the Clinton administration, the mistakes he made, he was declared dead within weeks of taking office. He never had a honeymoon. And some of you may disagree with what Bill Clinton stood for. Many of us disagree with what he obviously ultimately did. But it is very difficult for any president to govern, whether he be a Democrat or a Republican, if the country is not willing to give him an opportunity to lead. If the press will just back off and let somebody try to lead the country and not try to be so, cynical from the day one and so invasive and so, reaching for that opportunity to declare somebody dead before they even have a chance to take office. And if the other party will back off a little bit, and if we, the citizenry, will say, whoever wins this deserves support in order to get started, and let's see if we can't get this process going. As much as the next president needs to have a fresh start, we, the citizens, need to have declare a fresh start, too, because we have a responsibility as well. It is not enough just to go to the voting booth and say, well, I did my part. Now it's up to them, and it's a spectator sport from here on out. We'll sit on the sidelines and say, it's up to you guys. You go settle it. We're all bums anyway. That's not the spirit in which we're going to come together as a people. So the leadership that all of us call for today and that we so much need as a people also has to come from us. It has to be something rooted in us, that we have a faith in the system. We have spoken as a people. We spoke with a mixed message. But in the months ahead, I think all of us have a responsibility, whether some of us have the privilege of writing or speaking out in the public airwaves, to say we have a responsibility to act with a spirit of generosity, of understanding, and respect for those we have sent to public office. Thank you very much for your attention.
That was David Gergen, journalist and former presidential advisor, speaking today at the Westminster Town Hall Forum in downtown Minneapolis. Normally, of course, there's a question and answer period, but we are going to cut away from the Westminster Town Hall Forum now so that we can bring you some comments, an update, really, on the situation down in Florida, where the recount continues with officials trying to decide who's going to be the next, well, who won the Florida presidential vote, and as a result, who is going to be the next President of the United States. As you know, there has been a lot of controversy surrounding the voting process in Florida, and both campaigns, both the Bush campaign and the Gore campaign, have dispatched officials to Florida to oversee the recount. Both presidential candidates having selected former secretaries of state to take the lead role in overseeing those procedures. Governor Bush has selected former Secretary of State James Baker to serve as his chief advisor, and Al Gore has selected as his chief advisor in the matter former Secretary of State Warren Christopher. Mr. Christopher, William Daley, who was the chair of the Gore campaign, among others, has been meeting with reporters. And let's hear a little bit of what they have been saying to a news conference in Tallahassee.
Florida now for over 20 hours. And I'm here to report that what we have learned has left us deeply troubled. Most notably, it appears that more than 20,000 voters in the Palm Beach County, who in all likelihood thought they were voting for Al Gore, had their votes counted for Pat Buchanan or not counted at all. Because this disenfranchisement of these Floridians is so much larger than the reported gap between Governor Bush and Vice President Gore, we believe this requires the full attention of the courts in Florida and concerned citizens all around our country. More than 100 million Americans voted on Tuesday, and more voted for Al Gore than Governor Bush. Here in Florida, it also seems very likely that more voters went to the polls believing that they were voting for Al Gore than for George Bush. If the will of the people is to prevail, Al Gore should be awarded a victory in Florida and be our next president. Let me focus on the problem of Palm Beach County. There, due to the confusing ballot, many voters who believed they were voting for Al Gore had their votes counted for Pat Buchanan. No other explanation for his 3,400 vote total, a sum three times larger than what he did in any other county, and 10 times the number of registered reform voters as listed. This seems implausible. I am told that even Mr. Buchanan recognizes as much. Based on the totals from other counties, there seems every reason to believe that well over 22,000 of these votes were votes for Vice President Al Gore, more than enough to make him the winner here in Florida. In addition, there were more than 19,000 ballots cast in Palm Beach County that were not tabulated at all, because voters faced with this confusing ballot apparently punched two holes instead of one. These logical conclusions are reinforced by the phone calls, faxes, and other reports from over 1,000 residents of Palm Beach County that have poured into us saying that they believe they were victims of this ballot confusion. In response to this clear injustice, what does the Bush campaign say? They blithely dismiss the disenfranchised of thousands of Floridians as being the usual sort of mistake made at elections. They cite legal provisions about published ballots and technical notice. They put a demand for finality ahead of the pursuit of fairness. As for the substance of these responses, let me say that they are in doubt. It remains unclear if the sample ballot published really contained all the elements, including the alignment of the punch holes, that the actual ballot reflected. More importantly, let me be clear at what is at stake here. Technicalities should not determine the presidency of the United States. The will of the people should. Demanding an end to this election is not the same as demanding that the person who the people want as president takes office. Here's what we intend to do about this. Today, the appropriate Florida Democratic officials will be requesting a hand count of ballots in Palm Beach County, as well as three other counties, Volusia, Dade, and Broward. In addition, today I'm announcing that we will be working with voters from Florida in support of legal actions to demand some redress for the disenfranchisement of more than 20,000 voters in Palm Beach County. We believe that with so much at stake, steps should be taken to make sure that the people's choice becomes our president. In addition, we are still collecting accounts of other irregularities, voter intimidation, and other oddities in other parts of the state, and if substantiated and appropriate, they too will become part of legal actions. Now let me address the concerns of those who say that these actions will delay the conclusion of this election, or somehow we are seeking to drag this out. All we are seeking is this, that the candidate who the voters preferred become our president. That is what our constitutional principles demand. That is what true fidelity to our Constitution suggests. That is what the American people truly deserve. Moreover, we will move this matter ahead as quickly as is possible. We do not want delay. What we want, however, is democracy fulfilled. Finally, let me address some remarks to the Bush campaign. I believe that their actions to try to presumptively crown themselves the victors, to try to put in place a transition, run the risk of dividing the American people and creating a sense of confusion. Let the legal system run its course. Let the true and accurate will of the people prevail. And if at the end of the process, George Bush is the victor, we will honor and obviously respect those results. But we would expect the same adherence to the rule of law and democratic process from their campaign in return. Bold claims, not based on the will of the people, endanger the orderly transition of power. Taking the time to ensure that the people's choice is our president is the best way to respect our democratic values and honor our Constitution. At this time, let me ask former Secretary of State Warren Christopher to make a few brief remarks.
That was Gore campaign chair William Daley. And next up, as you heard, Warren Christopher, who's overseeing the count for the Gore campaign.
I associate myself with Chairman Daley's comments. If I could put it in a single sentence, we've come to believe that there are serious and substantial irregularities resulting from the ballot used only in one county, that ballot was confusing and illegal, and that arising out of this is the need for redress in order to make sure that the will of the people can be properly honored in this situation. Now, I think Secretary Daley and I, as well as Mr. Caulfield, will be glad to take your questions.
I think that's to be determined as we move forward. There are possible several different options that lawyers and others will be looking at, so we wouldn't want to presume today to determine what that redress should be. Yes, ma'am. Well, if you look at the results of over 19,000 people voted twice and their votes were uncounted. Those are official statistics that I've been given. Yes, ma'am. We believe, based on the vote in that county, if you were to just to take a, I mean, simply speaking, if you were to take a percent of that Al Gore got on the votes that were counted and put that into the 19,000 that were double, that punched two holes, then he would clearly have the votes. Right now, as I understand it, it's under 800, the spread between the two at this point in the recount.
Yeah. The ballot itself is illegal, in your words, Secretary Christopher, confusing as well. James Baker says earlier, about an hour ago, that indeed super ballots have been used in that same county in previous elections. Can you address that? And if so, where's the argument if indeed you're saying it is illegal? In addition to that, there's a suggestion also that officials from both parties have to give approval for that ballot before it goes to voters. Could you?
First of all, Secretary Baker may be a Floridian election law expert. I'm not. I'll ask Mr. Coffey if he wants to make a comment on that. The fact is, the argument that somehow a political official, his decision or non-decision should somehow negate the vote of a citizen just doesn't make any sense.
Florida election law is very clear. In fact, I think, as all of you know, this was apparently the only county in Florida that chose to use a confusing butterfly ballot, and the consequences, unfortunately, are apparent to all of us. Florida law requires a specific sequencing and a specific structure on the ballot precisely to avoid the sort of extraordinary confusion that resulted in the disenfranchisement of thousands and thousands of voters.
If I could just follow that up, because they're suggesting that if you say 2,000 of the Buchanan votes, which I think the total was a little more than 3,000 in that particular county, should have gone for Al Gore instead of Patrick Cannon. What number is that based upon?
That is based upon the percent of voters that went for Al Gore in that county, as opposed to Al Bush and George Bush. And if you took that percent of those votes for Pat Buchanan, they would amount to 2,000 or a little more.
You know, this ballot, usually it was confusing,
I have no opinion as to whether it was. It was obviously deliberately confusing to the people who went in there. I don't know whether the person who designed it deliberately did that to confuse people. We're not making that allegation. That doesn't matter at this point.
What is Florida law providing the remedy in a situation such as this?
There are a number of different remedies. We're not prepared to, at this point, limit the selection. Obviously, one of them could be an election. There are other remedies as well. Based upon a sufficiently conclusive showing, the judge might have different options. We're not going to comment more specifically on remedies, but it's important to emphasize there are more than one, and one of those possibilities is a new election in Palm Beach County.
That's the Kendall Coffey, the Gore campaign attorney that you just heard there. Coming up here is William Daley, now the Gore campaign chairman.
I have no idea what suits have been filed. No, we have not. The campaign has not filed anything. As I said in my statement, we are going to support legal actions. I've seen reported by some of your colleagues in other publications that some suits have been filed, but I don't know if they're in state or federal court. Yes, sir.
Vice President, you're going to concede this election if the results, the recount results, still show he's losing, or is he going to wait for the end of the legal process?
I think we will wait to the end of the process that shows who clearly won the election in Florida, and that will show that Al Gore did, if it's based upon a real count. Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. A hand count of the ballot, I'm not quite sure how long it takes. My impression from people is that it's fairly quick. Maybe Mr. Coffey can comment based on past experience, but I don't think it's a great delay. We're trying to expedite this process.
Why do you want a hand count in South Florida?
The officials of in the two counties, or the four counties that have remained, they thought there was enough evidence of reason for a hand count to make sure that the most accurate count is given to the public, and therefore this election, which is the closest election in this state, I would assume one of the closest, plus in history. Well, there are different remedies for different irregularities that may have taken place. That's one issue on the 20,000. Then there are issues in these specific counties beyond those 20,000 that should not be ignored. Yes, sir. Pardon me? No, I think that another election is, as Mr. Coffey has stated, are remedies that will be looked at by the courts further down the road. Yes, sir.
Daley, you said that you're going to wait until the end of the process.
Does that mean that you're going to be asking the state of Florida not to announce their recount today, or that you're going to encourage them to wait until the legal battle plays out?
Well, I obviously, it would be a, if someone was to announce an official vote when the process isn't over, there is still, as I understand it, again, not an expert in Florida law, overseas absentee ballots that can be received up until next Friday. And with a vote that's now within 800 votes, a spread between of 800 votes or less between the two candidates, it would seem hard to me that anybody can call something a certification, but it's not obviously a finality in the vote. Yes, sir. I have no idea. How many are out there?
The contention of Florida Governor Bush and other Republicans that there was plenty of time to say something about these Palm Beach County ballots, the way they were constructed. They were approved by Democrats.
Yeah, but that, as was stated, that should not negate the right of the voters when they go to the poll. A party official of either party doesn't have the right to disenfranchise thousands and thousands of voters in a county in Florida. I don't think anyone would believe that. And there is some question as to the exact comparison between the sample ballot that was published and the actual ballot and the look of the actual ballot that the people went into the polling place and used. Yes, sir.
Is it the role of election judges or poll workers to help people if they're confused or have a question about a ballot? Have you looked into whether or not people were being helped fill these out correctly?
Well, even the county officials in the middle of the day had realized that there was terrible confusion going on and had to put out a statement to the election workers because of this confusion. Obviously, election workers are well taxed and strained on election day, especially with the tremendous turnout that was going on. But there's no question, looking at the numbers and the results, that the confusion was massive in Palm Beach County.
This is William Daly, yeah. The Gore campaign chairman that you're listening
sometime
to.
Sometime today. Where you can't find out, hopefully. Secretary Christopher and I will meet with the Secretary of State today, but what we're saying is that any thought that a number that someone could come up with today is the final number is probably not realistic.
You're saying 800 votes?
No. Well, first of all, it's not going to be a final count because you've got absentee ballots, as I understand it, overseas absentee ballots that can be accepted up until next Thursday. We're not talking about the integrity of this recount or the accuracy of this number that may be put out, but that's not the final number, and that surely does not reflect the will of the people of Florida when they went to the polls on Tuesday. Yeah. No, I was watching CNN, and sometimes I believe them, and sometimes I don't. Yeah. Am I confident of what? Yeah, you know, this count that's going on right now, we're confident that it's moving along, and I guess we'll be finished sometime today. Yeah. I guess that remains to be seen as we move forward. Yes, sir.
This is William Daly, the Gore campaign chairman that you're listening to, responding to the Florida presidential vote count.
If I speak, if I'm not accurate, Mr. Coffey will correct me. My understanding is the recount is the actual putting the ballots back through the machine and counting them again, and that is what will be brought to completion today.
Yeah, what has happened in a number of places, a machine recount in some counties where we've had absolutely disastrous statistical aberrations such as Volusia, without a manual recount, the voters of Florida are not going to know what the truth is. So obviously there is a necessity for a manual recount. That has not been done so far. They have done, in effect, a machine recount. Typically that decision is made by the canvassing board in the specific county. Now, to date, even though it had been requested from the beginning that a very thorough, meticulous process that included manual recounts be done, the guidance that the supervisors have received from the Secretary of State's office has been to specify only machine counts. But ultimately, that decision is supposed to be made by the individual canvassing board in each of Florida's 67 counties. That ballot was completely illegal. It confused voters. It led to an unprecedented number of voters, many of whom were elderly, who waited for hours, who had their votes disqualified because it was very hard looking at it to figure out exactly what to do. The law requires not that you mix and match and overlap different candidates on either side, which was done with the butterfly ballot. What the law requires is a simple linear listing so that the boxes are punched in the same order and you don't have this massive confusion. You had 3,400 votes for Buchanan and Palm Beach. In Dade County, which is much bigger, 561, in Broward, 789, those numbers cry out for justice and for getting to the bottom and getting to the truth. Well, first of all, typically, supervisors of elections follow the law, as they did in 66 other counties. And frankly, the reality of this kind of mistake resulting in, as the Secretary said, 20,000 voters being disenfranchised in an election where right now there's an 800-vote difference has simply not arisen before. Obviously, nothing about this matter is precedented.
That's Kendall Coffey, the Gore campaign attorney. Now Warren Christopher approaching the microphone.
Well, he asked for the meeting, and so we'll hear him out and try to see if there's some way that we can cooperate with them. But I must say the cooperation cannot extend to the point of our giving up justified legal challenges that are absolutely necessary to ensure the fairness of the process.
William Daley, now the Gore campaign chairman.
No, it's not what number is acceptable. The process has got to be completed. As I stated, and as Governor Jeb Bush said, this is the first step, this recount. And then there's the absentee ballots that will come in. And we're raising some very serious questions, and legal actions will be taken. We do not want any delay either, but we want the American people's will, and that is the election of a president who has the most votes in our country to take place, and a majority of the Electoral College, obviously. I try not to do hypothetical questions, okay? Let's wait and see what happens with all the votes today and the absentees and beyond. Yes.
Can you give us a sense as to what the Vice President is doing, keeping track of it? What are his plans for the next couple of days? Because clearly the legal process is going to stretch out for a while.
I believe he and Tipper are still in Nashville taking it easy with their family. He is obviously following this development. He has a day job also as vice president that he's doing. And so he's very busy as he always is.
William Daley, the chairman of the Al Gore campaign, speaking in Tallahassee, Florida, just a few minutes ago. Mr. Daley, Warren Christopher, others overseeing the recount underway. And at last report, with 46 of the 67 counties recounted, the Associated Press now reports that the margin has shrunk to 793 votes. But Governor Bush continuing to lead in the recount. The Bush campaign officials have a press conference scheduled for 2:30 this afternoon to share their views on the recount and what should happen next. We will, of course, keep you posted here on Minnesota Public Radio. We're going to break for some headlines, but then off to Talk of the Nation today, Juan Williams continuing conversation.